2950. And in that spirit of winning something now and then, we're joined in the studio by Bijou Mathieu, who is occasionally appears in these airways as a producer. Is also one of the organizers from the New York Taxi Workers Alliance and an author of a new book just out from the New Press called Taxi, with an exclamation point, Cars and Capitalism in New York City. This is a story of the taxi industry in New York City, the Taxi Workers Alliance, and their success at actually winning some victories for the maligned and exploited drivers behind those yellow cabs. Welcome to the studio, Bijou.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me on the show. It's kind of been crazy after the books come out.
Yes, I bet it is. But how many people are driving yellow cabs in New York City?
At any one point in time, there are around 24,000 drivers active, 24 to 25,000 drivers who are active, though that doesn't reflect the number of licensed drivers. The number of licensed drivers is much higher. Number of licensed yellow cab drivers would be in the range of between 40 to 50,000.
And, in the book you recount the stories of drivers who say that passengers think that cab drivers make tons of money.
Yeah,
and, I don't know where that perception comes from, but it is really at odds with the facts, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's part of a psychological kind of thing that happens when you hand money over to people. There is an assumption that somehow that person to whom you're handing money over is making all that money. And unlike a store or something like that, wherein it's quite obvious that the person who is standing behind the counter is in most cases not the person who's got anything to do with the ownership of the store. In the case of taxis, because of a whole bunch of mythologies that have been built up over the last several decades, the general assumption is that somehow that those who drive the taxi own the taxi. And that's the furthest away from the truth that one can get.
That's true in some cases.
It's true in around 10 to 12% of the cases, but which means that 90% of the cases is not true.
And the arrangement in the industry is extremely unusual and extremely exploitative. Tell us about the leasing deal.
Yeah, I mean, the arrangements in the industry are extremely complicated. There are all sorts of ways in which the deals are structured. And I'll come to outlining the logic of it in a minute. But the two things to understand the basics of the economics of the industry. First and foremost is that four-character string that you see on top of the yellow cab, which is like a 4G44. That's the medallion number. There's a medallion. The medallion is the most important piece within the taxi industry. It's primarily the mode of production in a certain sense. The medallion is what entitles you to put a cab on a street. It's a permit. It was first sold in New York City in 1937 at $5. Right now, its open market value ranges anywhere between $300,000 to $400,000. In other words, to put one taxi on the street, you need to have control over capital to the tune of $350,000 to $400,000. Now, straight away, we know that that's out of reach for most people. And what that also turns around and says then is that the medallions are held or controlled by a close conglomerate of garages and brokers. Now, what does a driver do? The simplest arrangement that I'll outline is, let's say, a daily driver, a guy who goes into a garage every day and picks up a cab and drives, walks into the garage, let's say, at around 4:30 in the evening on a Friday night for a Friday night shift. He puts down $130 down on the table as lease money and then puts another $20 to $30 worth of gas, closer to $30, $35 these days because of the price of gas. And so he is starting his shift. He starts work at -$150, -$160, which means that the first several hours of a shift, 4, 5, 6, sometimes 7 hours of a shift.
And a 12-hour shift is pretty normal in the game?
Yeah, 12-hour shift is what is the structure. It is the accepted structure in the industry. There are almost no 8-hour shifts in the industry. So out of a 12-hour shift, the driver starts in the first several hours, 4, 5, sometimes 7, 8 hours of the shift are spent making up the money that he's already put down on the table for somebody else, for the owner, after which he makes the money to bring home the food for himself and his family. Now, you can straight away see that it's one of those, it's straight away an industry in which you're not only not necessarily assured of an income, you're not guaranteed an income, but it's one of those industries in which after 10, 12 hours of work, you may actually go home with no money in your pocket or actually negative money in your pocket.
In most industries, the worker is working most of the day for the much of the day for the boss, but and then some of the day for him or herself. But this really makes it explicit.
Yeah, I mean, see, that's one of the things that's there in the book. The book, incidentally, is called Taxi. As if you're hailing a taxi on the street, Taxi, Cabs and Capitalism in New York City, just out through the New Press. And the book itself, it's one of the things that one of the drivers, members of the Alliance mentions in the book. He says, in most places it's well hidden, the fact that you're working for your boss, that most of your labor is being expended to make money for your boss. That's pretty well hidden. It's in this industry that it's completely naked. And he says, that leaves me no room even for self-respect. I know that when I'm working as hard as I'm working, that it's obvious that, that most of the money is going to the boss, because I'm literally every minute I'm ticking off by counting how much more money do I have to make before I even break even.
So about 5 or 7 hours into this 12-hour shift before the driver actually starts making money for himself.
Absolutely. And, the point about this is that it's a dramatic departure from what used to be the arrangement in the industry. The arrangement in the industry prior to the 80s, that is still 1979, was what's called commission system. Now, under commission system, all drivers were employees of garages. That is, they got standard benefits as per the collective bargaining agreement, whatever be the agreement, vacation days, sick days, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what is more is that they split the meter as per a predetermined ratio in the collective bargaining agreement. That is, they split it 49% for the driver, 51% for the owner, 47% for the driver, 53% for the owner. And the owner paid for the gas and the driver kept the tips. In other words, at the end of a day, unless the split was really dramatically different, like 41, 59 or something like that, in most cases, the driver would come out even with the owner. That is, the driver and the owner would more or less split the meter. But this is the arrangement that was thrown out of the industry. Now, a few things to note about this. First and foremost is the fact that with the shift from commission to leasing, what effectively happened was that the entire risk of making money, the entire risk of a good day, bad day, mediocre day, something going wrong in the city, all of the risks of earning were shifted onto the back of the driver. Now, earlier, the driver and the owner, as is obvious when you're splitting the meter, shared the risk. If it is a really bad day and at the end of a 10, 11, 12-hour workday, the driver had booked only, let's say, $108. That still meant he would go home with something close to 50 or a little more than 50, and the owner would take something similar. Whereas now, if he ended the day at 108 or 110, he's going home at minus 40.
And we keep using the male pronoun here, but it is almost all men driving cabs now, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's predominantly men. There is no standardized evidence in terms of statistics, but it's our estimate, it's less than 1% women in the industry right now. This is dramatically down from around 8 to 9%, which was what it was in the 70s. So with the shift from commission to leasing, one has also seen the drop in the number of women drivers.
I'm speaking with Bijou Mathieu, who is the author of Taxi, Cabs and Capitalism in New York City, just out from the New Press. And what you describe, this shifting of risk from employer to worker, is really pervades the entire economy these days. The whole restructuring of the pension system is all about this. This is insecurity in employment is all about this. So this really crystallizes in a very intense form a lot of what's going on in the broader economy.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the theses in the book, which I outline in great detail, which is got to do with the fact that it's one of the core principles of what I would call the neoliberal economy, to shift risk downward towards those who have the least power within the system. And it's done through, things like, corporate buzzwords like outsourcing, downsizing, et cetera. These became buzzwords in the 90s. In the taxi industry, you see these structures emerge as early as the late 70s, early 80s. And
was all starting.
The whole imaginary around the neoliberal economy of how to shift that risk outward, owned to the people with the least power within the system, had already caught on. And part of the reason why I feel that it's visible in the taxi industry as early as the mid-70s, etc., in such a dramatic form, is because of one specific reason. I mean, think about labor. When we think about labor from the from the period of the Depression onwards till all the way into the 70s, what really came after the war, after World War II, was what one calls the Keynesian Compact, wherein there was a certain kind of quote-unquote a deal that was struck between labor and management, wherein the labor, I mean, given all the Fordist technology that has developed by then, essentially, labor came under the full regime and control of the of the bosses. I mean, you clocked in, you clocked out. It was 8 hours. You're standing there on the assembly line, twisting those. I mean, doing the same repetitive job. The worker had no control over his work, and he was completely timed in and structured into his work. In other words, the capitalist had gained that much control over the worker during that period, and And in return for every productivity gain, there was deal struck in terms of how much the worker would take out of every dollar gained. And that was the battle in terms of union negotiations, collective bargaining, etc. In the taxi industry, interestingly, this greed of the owner could never drive the worker, in the sense that once the driver left the garage, okay, the owner had no control. The owner had absolutely no control. So it is true that if a driver, for instance, drove 8 hours during the commission system and he felt he had made enough money and he wanted to take a long break, he would. Why not? You've just put in a huge amount of labor, right? But that is the point, that the worker could not be controlled in the same way. And the ownership tried various things. I mean, for instance, yeah, it would happen on a really bad day, for instance. At the end of the shift, let's say there's a driver, and now we're talking the 60s and the 70s, it's possible he's had a really bad day out there, and you have a situation wherein you're getting a ride, and you tell the guy, you know, let's just negotiate this on our own terms. I won't put the meter on. You know, I'll drive you to Brooklyn and give me $10. Because then the whole 10 can go into his pockets. It's possible that some drivers did that under trying circumstances.
I remember that, yes.
Right? Yeah. So now the point is that the owners reacted to all that. Now, there used to be something called the hot seat, you know, wherein if you the moment a passenger sits in the back seat, the meter would go on automatically. The drivers had their response to it, of course. They called the arm job, wherein you get to ride on the arm of the seat and stuff like that. So there were, you know, that battle was going on, and the owners were losing in a certain sense. They could never gain control. And so in a certain sense, the early entry of this form of leasing, I mean, this comes in the context of the fact that Nixon legalized leasing once again in the 70s. And so it all comes in that context. And the Taxi and Limousine Commission was created in the 70s. I'm kind of going all over the place, but it's all there in the book.
Yes, that book, it's important to point out, is available. If you pledge on this program for $125, you'll get this excellent book, Taxi, Cabs and Capitalism in New York City by Bijou Mathieu, which is just out from the New Press in a striking yellow cover, of course. You pick up the phone, you can hear the full story. Let's take a little musical break and then we'll come back. And that, an excerpt from the Internationale, as performed by Yuta Phillips and Ani DeFranco. And we're back here and behind the news. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're now joined in the studio by Rizwan Raja, who is a member of the organizing committee of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. Welcome to WBAI.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little. We've been talking about exploitation, but let's talk a little bit about resistance for now. The Taxi Workers Alliance, how long has it been around? How did it come into existence?
Well, we have been around since 1996 with another name. We were underneath another mother organization. Then we went our ways in early 1998. And in February of 1998, we got incorporated. And ever since, we are still in the business.
And I remember, I think I interviewed Bijou during that strike in May 98, when I first got to know you. And that was, 7 years ago now?
So, correct.
Yeah, what happened about it during that strike?
Well, it's a very fascinating story. We just came into our being in February, and then we have to pull off a wonderful strike in May of 1998. So it was, we were still in very infant, form of organization, and we were very small. But what happened was that basically Giuliani came up with his 17 new rules for the quality of life under the guise of quality of life. And basically what it does was, try to get rid of the labor force, basically. We thought that he is trying to recycle the labor force in the industry. And we resisted against it. We called for a strike on May the 13th. 1998, and we came up to the decision of the strike on May 3rd, actually. So we had only 9 days to work on it and pull off a strike, on the 10th day.
And it was very, very successful.
And it was. I think it was like one of the most successful strikes city has ever had in the cab industry. And this was like the first labor issue, which rebel, basically labor revolt against Giuliani, and that was the opening door of it.
On the face of it, this would look like a very difficult group of workers to organize. They don't work under the same roof like workers in a factory. They come from many different parts of the world, speak many different languages, many different interests and life stories. This is not, on the face of it, an easy population to organize. What was your strategy? How did it work out so well?
We have to work on the common grounds. I mean, no matter where you're from, how long you've been here, how long you've been driving, you are under the same set of guidelines. You are being abused in the same way. And and that was the commonality between a Haitian driver or let's say a Bangladeshi driver. So that helped us a lot. So that quality of life issues, those new rules, were affecting as much as the Caribbean drivers as the South Asian ones. So that was one good uniting issue.
And you mentioned at one point that the owners might try to pit one group against another, but that didn't take off.
Yeah, I'll just add a little to what Rizwan said. I mean, Rizwan points to the kind of unifying working condition situation that, will mobilize drivers in the end, and that's been the experience of the Taxi Alliance. I mean, we specifically moved away from a model wherein, the taxi industry has predominantly South Asian drivers, around 55 to 65% of the drivers at any one point in time over the last 15 years or more have been South Asians. And there is this tendency in today's political work to sometimes organize along ethnic lines, etc. And the Taxi Alliance moved away from that model and decided that we are organizing all taxi drivers, though we, as Rizwan said, that in 1996, we were at that point organizing Asian drivers, and we moved away from that model. And all of that's recorded in the book and established ourselves as an organization that's open to every driver. Now, the point is, the point simply is, I'll tell you a story to mark how it is that drivers come together. The strike, as Rizwan pointed out, was something that we had to pull off literally 3 months into our existence as the Alliance, and also with less than 10 days to pull the strike off. We were a small organization, a fledgling organization. Our membership stood to around 600 members at the time when we went in for the strike. But what we had built up was, with the last year and a half or two of work, a significant amount of recognition within the industry that we were the people who are mobilizing the industry, mobilizing the drivers, etc. And out of that context, for instance, when the strike happened, now, May 13th, it was 1 week after the Indian government exploded its nuclear test in India, and around 2.5 weeks before the Pakistan government was forced into responding to that and exploding their own nuclear device as a response to the Indian explosion. And there was tensions really high in the subcontinent. So May 13th happens. It's a 99% strike, less than let's say 100 drivers out there on the street plying their taxis. A lot of those that looked like yellow taxis that were working that day were what are called 6Y taxis, which are cop cars under the guise of being yellow cabs while running around wild on the streets. And at our strike headquarters on 40th Street and 8th Avenue, a lot of press came in, and I don't think a single person in the press missed the beat that day, walking up to an Indian or a Pakistani driver and telling him, "Your countries are nearly at war. Why are you hanging out together here?" And, I mean, the number of times, I mean, it's one of the moments early on.
Reporters can be so stupid sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those moments wherein, I was so proud of what we were doing, because literally every single driver who was asked that question turned around and said, "So what? I mean, when we are stopped on the street, we are not treated differently because we are Indian or Pakistani. We are given the same kind of treatment."
And I want to point out that it's not just economic issues that the drivers are exercised about. The harassment and the kinds of treatment they get from the police and the TLC is really horrible. So could you just give us some highlights, if you want to call it that?
Sure. I mean, there are certainly a lot of incidences happened to me a lot of times. That once a police, remember that TLC had their own enforcement arm, which Giuliani got rid of them or cut them to size and put it to the cops. So the NYPD had its unit called taxi unit. So whenever they used to sit on the, I think they still do it, they still sit on the main entrances for the cab drivers, like the PATH station or the Penn Station, Grand Central, Port Authority Bus Terminal, and virtually they have a quota to meet, and they will stop you if you are dropping somebody and can give you like so many tickets without any reason. I can give you a couple of examples. I can get 2 tickets for 1 hanging receipt in the meter. Can you imagine that, paying $200 for 1 receipt.
$200?
$200 for 1 receipt which my passenger refused to take.
That's like 2 good days of work we're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. 2 really good days of work. So, and they still do it. They basically, once they got you, they try to make up their quota. They don't want to work, like one by one. They want to meet their quotas very quick. So you are definite to get a sure shot. $500 worth of tickets in your hands. And TLC courts are not open. This is the key. They are not open.
So you're always guilty if you're before.
You are always guilty until you prove yourself innocent. And it's really hard to prove yourself innocent because the TLC inspector is working for the TLC and the judge is working for the TLC, and they are both in one single room, colluding for the driver, so you can imagine.
And so it's not only the fine that you lose, but it's the day of work that you have to go spend at
exactly.
this kangaroo court.
Right. If you have to go to that kangaroo court, they make you sit whole day, no matter what time of the day you go. If you have a summons which has a time of 8:30 in the morning, you're supposed to be there 8:15. If you are not, you are already found guilty. There was one time I went there 8:35, and I signed in. When I went to the window, and just been told that, "Oh, we have found you guilty." "Well, how come?" "I'm here." "Oh, well, you were not here by 8:30, so we have decided, you are pleading. You have been found guilty, so you have to appeal for that." And even if I'm there for 8:15, they'll make me sit until 4 p.m. to just to see a judge and get my my worth of bail, basically, you know, to be found guilty, whether I have justifications or whatsoever. The ticket is, yeah, I mean, there were so many instances then. There were so many mistakes on the tickets, and they are virtually invalid tickets. But they took their word and found the drivers guilty. I have one time a Pakistani driver telling me they look like, you know, Pakistan military courts.
And that is the voice of Rizwan Raja, who is a member of the organizing committee of the Taxi Workers Alliance and one of the stars of the book Taxi, with an exclamation point, by Bijou Mathieu, who is also here in the studio. The book just out from the New Press, the story of the taxi industry in New York City, the workers who are ruthlessly exploited by the taxi industry, and the efforts of the Taxi Workers Alliance to resist that exploitation, and sometimes quite successful efforts. And I need to stop here and say this is Behind the News, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM on the radio dial, WBAI.org on the web, and we need your money. That's what this is all about, 2950. So let me do another couple of minutes of interview before I return for extending the cup in hand again. That strike in 98 then led to a whole series of events, but there was something of a victory not all that long ago. I can't remember exactly when the fare got increased and the drivers got most of the proceeds. Tell us about that.
So, yeah, in 2003, actually, we started off our campaign for the higher fares and lower leases for the cab drivers, and we filed a petition with the TLC in April, and we had we started our campaign with having the John Liu, the city council member from Queens, he's the head of the transportation committee, coming to our meeting and and putting his support behind us. And And it was a large campaign. I mean, it was huge. We worked for around a year. And in April, I mean, in last year, in 2004, in March, actually, when we got our petition passed, not exactly the way we wanted to, but, it gave the drivers the better part of the fare increase. And that's like the first time in the history of this cab industry that we had a fare increase which actually benefited the drivers, the workforce, rather than the owners, you know.
And just to add to what Rizwan was saying, I mean, the book itself, for instance, the first chapter is called The Distance Between Two Victories, and it's looking at two back-to-back victories. One is with the Federal Emergency Management Assistance Program post-September 11th, and I'll come back and talk about that. But the fare increase itself, I mean, as Rizwan said, it was a year-long battle, a little more than a year, as a matter of fact. And it was a piece of negotiation that proved, in a certain sense, that how far we had come since the strikes of 1998. As I said, when we went in for the strikes of 1998, we had a membership of around 600. By the time we came to the negotiating table in 2003, our membership was around 5,000 members. And one of the things that Bhairavi Desai, who was our executive director, said at that time is, the moment we stepped into that room for the negotiation, in a certain sense, the whole industry had changed because we, the taxi drivers, are independent contractors. And what we had forced was forced the city and the ownership to recognize drivers in the category of labor and come back to the table to negotiate with us. So in that sense, it was even before we got the fare increase that we wanted, it was already a victory. But of course, we got the fare increase that we wanted. And just to kind of give some statistics to add to what Rizwan said, the best deal for the drivers for a long, long, long time. The previous collective bargaining agreement that made any sense for drivers was way back in 1967. And so in a certain sense, this was a big, huge victory after around 40 years, nearly 40 years. And the previous fare increase that happened in the taxi industry was 1996. And the ownership took 86% of the money. Drivers got 14%. As per what we negotiated down with the TLC, finally in March of 2004, was that the drivers would take 68% of the fare increase and the ownership would take 32%.
That was the voice of Biju Mathieu, who is the author of Taxi, just out from the New Press, and also one of the organizers of the Taxi Workers Alliance. And you mentioned Bharvai Desai, who is not here, but certainly a very, very important figure in this fight, the executive director of the Taxi Workers Alliance. I remember back in the 98 strike watching her addressing a crowd of drivers, and this little woman, dominating this crowd of big men. It was really quite a sight by the force of her personality. It was just amazing to see her strength and her power commitment to this fight.
Absolutely, Doug. I mean, I think one of the things that the entire workforce and a lot of us who've been organizing with her feel is that, I mean, rarely does a person like her come along who has the kind of vision and the capacity to organize as Bharvi does. Yeah.
And we do need you to pledge. We'll get you a copy of this excellent, excellent book, Taxi, by Biju Mathieu, just out from the New Press. It's a story of many, many things, not just the taxi industry and the workers who drive the cabs, but of a tremendous effort at resistance in the form of the Taxi Workers Alliance. But it's also a microcosm of a lot of the economic and political and social changes that have been going on in this city, this country, and this globe over the last 30 years, the neoliberal era. And as Biju has been pointing out, this really is the labor structure is a sterling example of just how neoliberalism is working in practice at the grittiest level of day-to-day life. 212-209-2950, the number to call. And you were saying that the TLC, which in case people don't recognize that, that's not tender loving care, that's a taxi and limousine commission. They have plans to put tracking devices in cabs. What's that about?
Right. Part of the bill they passed through for raising the cab fares was they tracked, like, one segment of the bill was that to improve the conditions of the cab, and they wanted to put clearer partitions. And obviously, the cab drivers, the labor itself, has to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And they want to put a GPS system, global positioning system, so that they will know, they can track down each and every cab at every moment. And basically, the reason they're saying that people are losing things in the cabs, and the other reason they gave us, like, try to calm drivers down, that you don't have to write a trip sheet. A trip sheet is a paper where you have to record all your trips, and a lot of cab drivers who miss even one get like $100 tickets on it. So they're trying to sell it that, oh, you don't have to worry about $100 tickets because, you know, we will know where you were and where you pick up and all that stuff. So it's basically entering into the driver's privacy.
Well, this is like what UPS does, similar things. They track drivers everywhere. They track minute to minute. So it seems like they're trying to impose, like, really, really tight control over what the worker is doing at every second of the shift, right?
See, that's the point. I mean, I don't think any worker should be tracked at all. Workers, it's a fundamental blow at the worker's self-respect when you start doing that. But the interesting contradiction here is, at one level, they want to call taxi drivers independent contractors. At another level, they want to exercise the same level of control that owners feel they are entitled to over employees. Now, that's the fundamental contradiction here. And second, let's face it, GPS is a military technology. And in this day and age, in the day and age when Homeland Security is going completely wild, and in this day and age when in an industry where more than a large, overwhelming majority of the drivers are Muslim drivers, one cannot but start by thinking that this may actually be coming down from somewhere else, right?
Yeah, well, you mentioned Homeland Security, and in the days after 9/11, a lot of cab drivers were harassed rather nastily. Is that still going on?
Yeah, still. I mean, it's still going on, and not only by police and authorities. Cab drivers got arrested and being deported from Brooklyn in droves. Literally, Homeland Security will have to come and take a block and go door to door, knocking each door and taking out people, asking them for their IDs and prove that they are not here illegally. If they cannot, they're sent home. And mostly like Pakistani cab drivers who were doing nothing wrong except that their visas have been expired or for one reason or the other. And they were taking them as if they are terrorists. And that's what they were, you know. And that sense of, you know, being abused is still going on, not only in New York. I mean, I just got an email from Cleveland and cab drivers there, the you know, Somali cabbies at the Cleveland airport got ticketed for not being into their cabs because they were praying together outside their cabs. So you can imagine, you know, it's not only New York, but all over the country. So it's like a state of mind which this these paramilitary forces are in. And that's what they are doing, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to add that, Tim, and there are so many cases. I mean, Rizwan kind of did point to lots of cases where the administration and the various arms of the administrative structure, starting from anything from the INS to the Taxi and Limousine Commission, harass drivers. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of harassment that comes from some passengers also. I mean, passengers, bystanders, anybody and everybody somehow feels free to take a shot at taxi drivers. I mean, and there's something about that mentality. And in a certain sense, I would say a lot of that comes from the time of Giuliani. Giuliani kind of, you know, the kind of epithets that the Giuliani administration threw at taxi drivers. Way back in 1998, if you remember.
Taxi terrorists.
Exactly. Safer, saying taxi terrorists. Now, it kind of made it, the kind of logic, the kind of discourse that was established was you can do anything to taxi drivers and get away with it. I mean, especially post-Iraq war, especially as the kind of tension around the last presidential election built up, the number of attacks that drivers faced in the street just went up quite dramatically. I mean, one of our organizing committee members, Mamnoon Ul Haq, recently was stabbed by a passenger. A hunting knife that went in 6-7 inches into his back. I mean, that he survived was a miracle. I mean, and Mamnoon's case was just one of the many cases. There are so many drivers who've been attacked in the last 6 months by bystanders, by passengers. And the interesting thing is that the TLC, you know, acts and behaves as if these are odd incidents that happen, exceptions, rather than the fact that this is quite a regular incident. And instead of trying to do something about that, instead of trying to do something on the health of the drivers, okay, these drivers have no health benefits. They think of a technology like GPS, which has absolutely no meaning for a driver or for a passenger.
Well, if you can get a ticket for $100 for a receipt hanging down for the meter, and they don't really care about drivers getting beaten and stabbed and, you know, just verbally harassed. I mean, this is a really, really screwed up set of priorities, isn't it?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's the logic for thinking of things like GPS and all of this kind of stuff is with the fare increase, it's almost like if the passengers, if the customers are paying more, somehow you have to give something back to the customers. Drivers did not get an increase in the meter since 1996. Everything is costlier in the city since 1996. I mean, when a customer walks into a supermarket and has to pay extra for a tomato, does he expect a better tomato? No. I mean, so where is this logic coming from that just because the fare went up, you have to give something back to the passengers?
Now, as I recall, New York City cab fares are actually fairly low compared to other big cities, right?
It is amongst the lowest in the world, as a matter of fact. If you take the first world, if you take the West, it is one of the cheapest taxi services in the world. And mind you, that is done essentially by keeping the drivers at, hovering around minimum wage or just a little above minimum wage. That's the modus operandi. I mean, it's, of course, volumes. The city is a really busy city, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I mean, the earnings of a driver are connected to the lease and the metered fare. If the leases keep going up, then you can increase the meter as much as you want, but the driver won't make money.
That was the voice of Biju Mathieu, who is the author of the book Taxi, just out from the New Press. And you can get a copy of this book by pledging $125 to WBAI. Let me just ask a couple of questions before I come back to a little more begging. Are there taxi worker alliances, taxi unions elsewhere in other cities in the United States, or are you guys unique?
After the industry went through a transformation nearly all across the United States, organizing was at a low end, and the taxi alliance is, in a certain sense, one of the first to start that process. But now, more and more, you're hearing a whole bunch of new stories of organizing efforts. In Philadelphia, as a matter of fact, just a couple of months ago, a whole group of drivers have started the Philadelphia Taxi Workers Alliance, as a matter of fact. They've named their group the Taxi Workers Alliance because of their contact with us. And, I mean, it's almost we built a really strong relationship with them over the last several months. Similarly, in Chicago now, they're organizing efforts. San Francisco has had it for a while. So has Boston, a small group of very active drivers. So the work is spreading in a certain sense, and that's what's good about this. And, I mean, for me, what's also important about the book is to document the fact that, you know, all of these different struggles are beginning elsewhere, but also all the other workers' struggles across the world. I mean, the book is, in that sense, take on the taxi industry and what's happening to the workers, immigrant workers in this industry. So it's a book as much about migration and the conditions that migration produces. It's as much about urban change and the kind of global city, the finance, insurance, real estate, the fire city that's been created out of New York. It's as much a book about multiculturalism and the failures of that to and all of that. So it's a broad book, and I think that's the spirit in which I bring the book to the listeners here on WBAI. I hope that all of you will, support WBI through this very difficult period. I mean, 99.5 is really, really, really prime real estate. Let's just face it. And if we don't have the money to support a radio station, that piece of real estate comes up asking all over again. And you know, we really should be doing our bit.
Yes, you all should be doing your bit, as Biju Mathieu just pointed out. Biju, the author of the book Taxi. And he's right. It's a very fine book about many things that come together around the taxi cab. Time 212-209-2950, the number to call. Please do call. And thanks to Biju Mathieu and Rizwan Raja for coming into the studio. And Biju, good luck with the book. And 212-209-2950 is the number to call. And we're going out with a little Stefan Grappelli playing Internationale.
Thank you much, Doug.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.